Welcome to the Fundamentalists Podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Elliot, and I'm here with Peter.
Elliot C. Morgan.
Elliot C. Morgan. And if you're just joining us, this is a podcast where I, myself, a comedian, speak with Dr. Peter Rollins from Northern Ireland, who is a theologian.
Well, and a philosopher, yeah.
You prefer philosopher. I feel like when I say philosopher, you say you're a theologian. When I say theologian, you say you're a philosopher.
I just like to mix it up.
Yeah.
I like to keep you on your toes.
Yeah, apparently. Pick one. So we were talking, somebody said recently about this podcast, which we're getting back into the swing of doing things. So thank you for your patience, everybody. We are aware that we have been maybe a little lax on posting episodes.
A little slack.
There are more episodes in the pipeline coming. So this is, we can say with a certain sense of certainty that there are plenty more episodes coming. But this is December 8th is right when we're recording this one.
Are you allowed to say that?
Yeah.
Then people know if this doesn't go out until February.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, in case we get a bug under
us. I suppose we didn't say the year, so we could.
Yeah, that's right. So this is a December 8th, one of them. But somebody was saying that this is a podcast where basically after our miracle in Big Bear Lake episode, that it's like I'm the believer and you're the skeptic,
yeah,
but you're the theologian and I'm the gallivanting, freewheeling, wild child.
Yeah, you're supposed to be the cynical comedian, bitter, burnt out, but really secretly you're a believer.
Yeah,
in stuff, in like the beauty of the universe, there's a hand guiding your life.
There's a hand
you
guiding
are special. That you're a unique snowflake.
I am a unique snowflake. Yeah. Yes,
and I'm the one who supposedly am well trained in kind of more theological things, and that has led me to be more skeptical of such things.
You have seen behind the curtain, and I'm still like, it's a beautiful curtain.
You love the curtain.
That curtain was put there by the Lord.
Yeah.
Well, this is a very exciting episode for a few different reasons. Before we dive into everything, if you would like to help support this podcast and get us back into our mode of creative output, you can support the podcast by going to trywink.com/fundamentalists. Wink, W-I-N-C, is a wine company, and they'll tell you what kind of wines you like, and they'll send them directly to your door, and they're super hip looking. So over the holidays, if you're like, hey, I want some wine for people to come over, have some extra bottles, do that. And if you do that, it helps support the podcast, and also you get $20 off or $25 or something like that. trywink.com/fundamentalists, ladies and gentlemen. And for those of you who have done it, thank you for doing it. It does help, and you are doing it, and we appreciate it.
Yeah, thank
you. Do you want to tell people the title of this podcast, since this is one of the rare times where we know the title before we actually...
Yeah, although now that you're saying that, I'm like, oh, what was it? I'm going to say it, and then you're going to correct me, because I know I'm going to get it wrong. Was it Happily Depressed?
That you got it.
I got it. Okay, Happily Depressed.
Happily Depressed. So here's what happened. I have been on a kick of utter and complete happiness and contentment.
Yep. Yeah, have
you never been happy?
You've been enjoying your life.
I love life very much, Pete. And only recently did someone suggest doing the typical, and I don't know, this might be power of suggestion, all this stuff, but somebody was like, you seem a little depressed and you seem a little heartbroken, was the word that was used. And when that question was asked, I was very like, I felt it like, no. And like, I was like, no, I'm fine. And that started this whole conversation about sort of like, how I tend to process things, and I sort of ended a, I guess, relationship, and so then I'm sad about that, and then like processing that whole thing. But at the same time, and we were talking about this extensively when we were hanging out one night, life is wonderful. It's the best. My life has never been better. Excuse me. And I'm under the weather, so I'm sorry for all the coughing in this episode.
You can't even say the words. You stop yourself with a cough.
What was the word that I stopped?
Life couldn't be better.
No, I got it out.
You got
it. Yeah.
And then you choked on them.
Yeah, no.
Here's a good thing example is that, you know, you go like, you're so happy because you went and you bought a Christmas tree and you bought lights and you bought
stuff to put in the Christmas tree. I see where you're going with this.
Yeah, you see where I'm going with this, because you go like, you did kind of go overboard. You didn't just buy a small Christmas tree. You went and bought a massive Christmas tree and spent a lot of money on a little carpet to go around it, on the lights, on a fancy, not just a regular star for the top, but a fancy lit one. And
yeah, I spent
basically
so much
the Christmas tree, all it screams to me is despair.
Yeah.
I am in disavowed despair.
I don't believe that it screams despair at you. It definitely screams mirth and joy. Look at that thing. It's beautiful.
If you go into someone's house and they've gone so overboard with Christmas decorations, you know that their life is in utter despair.
Yeah.
It's like whenever someone has all of their happy holiday photos on Instagram showing how happy they are. It's like, oh.
Sure.
If you were really happy, you wouldn't be thinking about putting all those photos up.
Well, there's cause and effect. I think I was sad on a Sunday. You weren't back from Ireland yet.
Which is why you were sad.
That's part. I was definitely, you were gone for so long.
I know, man.
I go crazy if I'm not. Apparently, I'm not. I shouldn't be left to my own devices. When you were gone for a long time, I was like losing my mind. I can lose my mind here really. I
was wondering if I would walk in and you'd be in the corner shaking with mud all over you.
No. I washed it off right before you got. I knew when your plane plane arrived. But yeah, no, I went. I was real sad, and I was like, screw this. I was like, I'm gonna take control. I'm gonna go get a Christmas tree.
Yeah.
And I went to Target, and I got this.
And you didn't just get a Christmas tree. No, I mean, you got the Christmas tree.
Yeah.
Christmas tree.
It's ridiculous.
It looks so perfect that the first thing I thought was, this is on the set of a TV show.
It's too perfect.
And it's too perfect. And a few people have said that. That has been a comment that a few people have said, is that this tree is
aggressively nice.
Aggressively perfect.
It's pretty, though.
Screams of despair.
Oh, it's so nice at night. Yeah, it is
beautiful at night. I am happy for your sadness because it has given me something beautiful to look at.
I will say, though, yeah, it did help. It did. The Christmas tree really does help. That's funny. We were filming a Your Show yesterday, and they were like, what's your favorite elements
Stop
of Christmas?
Stop promoting your other stuff.
I know.
Man,
you, at yourshow.com/YouTube. Yeah. I was like, they were like, what's your favorite element of Christmas? And I said Christmas tree. And then thinking back on it, when I was feeling down, I was like, well, I don't need to feel down. I'm gonna take control of my destiny and whatever. And it did help a little bit. It does help when you get out and do things. And that brings us full circle to the impetus of this. Is that the right word? Impetus? The beginning point?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think it works.
We'll slide it in there. But we were talking because neither you nor me have been going out at all. And not only that, I mean, barring me being under the weather, I am not going out for comedy shows. I'm not going out to hang out with people. I'm not dating. I'm quote unquote happier than I've ever been.
Yes.
And I am going to bed at 10 and waking up at 6 and then repeating that cycle over and over again.
And the interesting thing, the reason why we wanted to talk about this is because a friend just threw out one little question. I love this question. In the midst of you going, I'm really happy, I'm enjoying the house, I've got a beautiful Christmas tree, life is great.
Oh, all the work all the good, like there's really exciting stuff happening with the Valley Folk that's like mind boggling. Yeah. And so I'm just
all
like,
of this amazing stuff. And then one little prick into the fortress is just a question, which is, are you maybe a little bit unhappy?
Yeah.
And that's the Archimedean point that can bring everything down.
Well, let's slow down, Pete. What's Archimedean?
The Archimedean point is, it's a point in mathematics where, like, say, where basically if you've got a big rock, you can, if you get the Archimedean point, I'm going to explain this terribly, but is the point where you can move that rock with the minimum of force. Mm. So there's something massive, but if you get the right place, you can create a
point
wedge,
of vulnerability almost.
Yeah. That can move it. So people use the phrase to mean like you can have something that is very solid and big, but the Archimedean point is the place of weakness.
It's almost like the straw that breaks the camel's back, even though that implies that there's other straws and It was that Archimedean point, which got in my head. And and so that got in the discussion of both of us potential. I was like, well, maybe Pete's depressed too. And then we started talking about the idea of like, yeah, we might, both of us might be a little depressed. And this is where we're at, though. It is part of life and it happens.
And a bit of depression isn't bad.
And when I say depressed, I mean like, I don't mean it in like the clinical sense. I feel like I always have to say, because people, when they talk about depression, I think I'm talking about being depressed, not about the, but I don't know what the.
But this is a funny thing, like that Soren Kierkegaard was very good on, right? He was one of the great philosophers of despair. And the interesting thing about him is he talked about the despair of not knowing you're in despair, which is a very psychological concept. The idea that people think depression is subjective, like you know when you're depressed, like, how could you not know when you're unhappy? It's the most obvious thing. If you're unhappy, you will experience unhappiness. But Kierkegaard was saying, well, no, you can be unhappy and not know it. You can be, in fact, You can be at parties every night. You can be out with people all the time. You can fill your life with so much. And really, actually, you're doing that precisely because you are depressed. You're not like if somebody in my family once went to the doctor because she had heart palpitations and they couldn't find anything wrong with her. And the doctor finally said, I think you might be depressed. And she was like, no, you know, I'm out all the time. I'm hanging out with people. I'm always social. Like I fill my life with so much stuff. And the doctor was perceptive enough to go, yeah, well, sometimes that's what people do when they're depressed because they can't face a moment of silence. Because if they have a moment of silence, they will basically confront that monster. Yeah.
This does not sound like an American doctor.
No. Yeah. Well, I know your doctor. Your doctor's a great doctor. Yeah, so I won't say anything bad.
Yeah, I know. My doctor's, he's a
but really, might, well. Might prescribe you some happy pills or something.
Yeah, he'll take care of it real quick.
Yeah.
I'll be feeling better an hour later after I go. It's a fascinating time. I don't know, man. It's like, I don't care that much either. Like, I'm not like, I guess I've heard that as part of it too, where it's like, ah, whatever, it'll change when it changes. I'm about to leave here in a couple hours. I'm gonna drive to San Francisco and do a comedy show, and we're gonna stop halfway in a little hotel. We're gonna do a little road trip, me and my buddy Delman. I'm super excited. I haven't hung out with Delman in a long time. He's Lee's husband. And and
stop promoting your
Lee, who I work with at the Valley Folk. So we're gonna get to hang out, we're gonna get to have fun, and I'm just not. And he said, too, he's like, I guess it'll hit me tomorrow. And I was like, we're both kind of in that same zone. But I was like, yeah, man. I was like, I know I will have fun. Like, here's what it is. I am having fun most of the time. Or, like, I'm enjoying life most of the time. That's obviously not totally true. As I'm saying it, obviously
it's
not
true. You say it
content,
all the time.
Content. That's, I'm content. Yes.
You say that you're enjoying life a lot.
I do say that. Yeah. And so, but then I'm like, at least content. I'm like pretty like, this is fine.
Yeah. Yeah. You're having a good time.
Yeah. Just chill. And then, but I'm not like, I'm not looking forward to any of this stuff. I'm not like,
yeah.
You know, the luster of, and we were filming something yesterday at the Valley Folk, and it was like, they were like, what was it? Oh, they were talking about stand up, and I was like, yeah. And they were like, is it just not the same like luster for you? Like, is it not exciting for you? And I was like, it's part of it, yeah. And it's just like other stuff, you know, whatever. And, like, I shut down the conversation, but yeah, there's a whole, and then also I was still under the weather and was under the weather then, but yeah, there's this whole thing of like, I'm enjoying the things, but I'm not, there's no anticipatory-ness to any of it.
I mean, here's a thought. If I was a chemist, if I'd learned chemistry, I think there is a rule for a tablet that you get which makes you unhappy. Because what most people do is you go to the doctors to get happy pills.
Mm-hmm.
But a more existential type of tablet would be a tablet that helps you connect with your own unhappiness. And that could be more useful. Now, I'm not a chemist, so I can't, and I don't think I'll make my fortune from this, but if you could get a tablet...
I look forward to seeing what you make your fortune from.
Yeah, but if you could make a tablet that could connect you with your own disavowed unhappiness, that could be the first step to overcoming your unhappiness. That's the existential idea.
I would take that pill. I would be like, I'd take a pill to find out what's going on.
Yeah. So that's it. So that pill is called philosophy. Yeah. So that's what philosophy is. If philosophy is a pharmaceutical, or one of the one type of philosophy is a type of pharmaceutical pill that helps you connect with your own disavowed self.
You mean continental philosophy is that type of philosophy?
Yeah. Right? Yeah. That's very, very good.
I'll be here all day, folks.
Yeah. We should talk about the distinction between continental and analytic philosophy someday. Maybe we did already.
Yeah, what is, just for people have a cursory overview.
Oh, wow.
And I'll explain it, Pete.
Yeah.
Continental philosophy.
I'll be back in half an hour.
Yeah, exactly. We'll begin, ladies and gentlemen, please have a seat. We'll begin with continental philosophy. Continental philosophy is the approach to philosophy as though it actually could help your life. An analytic philosophy is a bunch of nerds who read a bunch of history books and haven't had a lot of sex.
I think I fit.
I'm kidding, of course. Continental philosophers haven't had a lot of sex.
You were explaining my life here. Like, I'm an analytic philosopher. All right.
But you're welcome. That's all you need to know. What would be an actually accurate?
Yeah, it's difficult because in some ways they hit on the same questions, and some philosophers kind of like move between the two. But they're two different orientations to philosophy. Analytic philosophy is more interested in mathematics, and more interested in, it's less interested in the history of philosophy, and it's less interested in what the concept of nothingness. And continental philosophy is much more connected with the history of philosophy and much more connected with the notion of nothingness.
Oh, interesting.
But that would take a long time to parse out. A lot of people would disagree with me on that, but actually I do think that if you want to define the difference between analytic and continental philosophy, you can start with how they define nothing.
Yeah.
Which is,
but anybody who disagrees with you on that point, I already am checked out.
Is that right?
Like, I don't want to hear that. I don't know. I know so little about those words that to hear that you're defining them wrong doesn't matter to me in the least, because I only know those words in the context of what you just said.
Ah, yes.
Like, if you introduce a concept, you're like, this is what this is, and like, people would disagree. It's like, well, I don't know those people. I don't know how they would.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have a clue.
Was he?
Or why it would even matter.
Well, the reason why I think it's a good way to approach it, and it's just the reason why I think some people would disagree, is more because I'd need to put more meat on the bones. The meat on the bones is that in continental philosophy, analytic philosophy is very, very much grew out of what can you know? What can you talk about? What can we have a certain sense of knowledge about?
Yeah.
And continental philosophy...
Like the hand that guides us.
Say it again?
Like the hand that guides us through our lives.
Oh, yes.
Like how I have a certain knowledge of I am the believer and you being the skeptic, you don't have that knowledge yet. You haven't learned about it yet.
Although ironically, in that sense, analytic philosophy grows up from an attack on the invisible hand that guides you.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
That's why you're a continental philosopher deep down, because you are a believer.
Yeah, of sorts. Well,
of sorts.
No, so yeah, analytic philosophy grew up in what can you know, what can you be certain about? Descartes, I think, therefore I am. And continental philosophy has largely been interested in what you can't know, like the unconscious, the limit experiences, the cracks in our rationality. And you'll just notice that orients thinkers in various ways. But anyway, that's all boring. Nobody cares. We've just lost half of our audience. I'm glad you said boring.
Jeez, yeah, I was
losing. Let's get back to the interesting thing.
Absolutely losing it. Yeah, let's get back to my love
life. In fact,
we
may have to edit that out.
No, I like it. I like it. We'll just let people, maybe if anything, we'll add like an intermission beforehand and be like, if you need to grab a drink or something, Pete's going to
come back in three minutes.
Man. So what do? You're happily depressed. You're sitting around. Enjoy life. We enjoy life as much as I can imagine enjoying life. And I feel like I have a good grasp on all of it. You know what's interesting, though? Here's the interesting part, Pete. Mm-hmm. Here's where it gets fun. This is the fun part. It takes one gosh darn question, and then all of a sudden, I'm like, nee. And now I got to get over this nee thing, and I guess all I can do is wait. I just have to wait till one day I'm not going meet anymore. But right now I'm in a meet mode.
Yeah. I mean, well, the first stage, that's why I was talking about a pharmaceutical that helps you connect.
I wouldn't be in this
with your subjectively.
I've taken the pill.
Well, I mean, yes, maybe, but it's always difficult to do. But to connect your objective unhappiness with your subjectivity, that's what this pharmaceutical pill would do. And that is the first step. Is to connect
your objective unhappiness, like the very fact that you are unhappy, is independent of how happy you think you are.
Yeah, your unhappiness.
That's so fun.
Your unhappiness is in the Christmas tree, not in your mind, right? It's like, if you
the Christmas tree made me happier. You're right, dude. It's the gosh darn Christmas tree. When the Christmas tree was erected, this phallic symbol of forced happiness thrust into the pelvis of thrust into the vagina of this living room, it brought about a sense of temporary bliss that only in the wake of the orgasmic realization of my own sadness am I able to confront the actual objective impotency of my constant and relentless push forward into ignorance.
Okay, well, that maybe, yes.
Yeah, maybe.
And to put it in a nutshell,
Christmas
tree is a monument to your unhappiness.
Yes.
We have a monument to your unhappiness. Now, this is just the same as if you have a kid and you ask the kid, do you like daddy? And the kid says, oh yeah, I think daddy's great. But then you ask the teddy bear, does teddy bear like daddy? And then the child says, no, teddy bear doesn't like daddy at all. Teddy bear thinks daddy's an idiot, right? The teddy bear is the one that's telling the truth. The child doesn't subjectively know that they have a problem with daddy. The teddy bear knows it. And so you're talking to the wrong person when you're talking to the child. You should be talking to the teddy bear. So basically, I shouldn't be talking to you about your unhappiness. I should be talking to the Christmas tree, because the Christmas tree knows what you don't know. But when you come to realize what the Christmas tree knows, that's the first step. The first step is you now know what the Christmas tree knows.
Well,
which is like the child getting to know what the teddy bear knows, because the teddy bear knows that they don't like daddy, but the child doesn't know.
You know, though, here's the thing, though. Christmas is magical.
Mm-hmm.
That's something we should discuss.
Yeah.
If anything is going to save me from twiddling my thumbs and being sad or being woe is me, it's going to be Christmas stuff.
Yeah.
What is it with Christmas stuff? It is truly like, it works, man. We light this candle, place starts smelling like Christmas. It's delightful.
Yeah.
It's absolutely delightful. I will sit here. You've seen me do it almost, probably almost every evening, where I'll sit out here, have a drink, and just stare at the goddamn Christmas.
Yeah, or you've been watching Ron Swanson drinking whiskey.
Drink whiskey.
There's
next
a 10-hour video of Ron Swanson drinking whiskey.
Do we have beer?
We have some beer, yeah. Do you want a beer?
I would like a beer. You want a beer?
Yeah, okay, yeah. Will we pause for a second?
I don't see why. Well, you want to talk about continental or analytic philosophy?
You get the beer, and I'll say something about Christmas.
Okay, yeah, thank God. Just not about continental philosophy.
Because Christmas has the same structure that we're talking about, right? It's magical often because, right, we don't believe in Santa Claus. If you're an adult, you don't believe in Santa.
Oh, I hadn't thought
about it. Right? But you can get the magic of the belief through a child believing. So if you've got kids and your kid believes in Santa Claus, you don't believe in Santa Claus in your own mind, but you kind of believe through the child's belief. So when the child stops believing in Santa Claus, you feel the horror of it. And that is a weird structure again of where your own belief isn't within your mind. It's actually within the mind of the child. The child is holding your belief for you, and you can therefore enjoy all of the magic of Christmas without believing in the magic of Christmas, as long as there is some naive other, the child, who believes in it for you on your behalf.
And the naive child is within me in this particular case with the Christmas tree, because I can fool enough of myself, that sweet little boy in me, that he'll enjoy the Christmas festivities. I believe, Pete, that the person I'm going to vote for in the 2020 election, regardless of what political platform they're on, is the person who is going
who
to...
Who fights for Christmas. The war against Christmas.
The war on Christmas. If you tell me I say happy holidays... You know what, though? The happy holidays thing, I came full circle on. I definitely grew up in my college years really hating the happy holidays thing. I was like, come on, can we just say Merry Christmas? Because it did... You know, when you're told there's a war on Christmas and you're young, you can believe it. But anyway, yeah, I miss the whole thing. But now I don't give a crap. But we move on. But Christmas, I want legislation put in place that adults are no longer allowed to speak about the absence or the lack of existence of Santa Claus.
Okay.
I don't want it. I was talking about this with a friend. I think that it shouldn't be allowed. I think
But this is the precise reason why it can be allowed. It can be allowed because you can disbelieve in Santa Claus and talk about it while still getting the psychological pleasure of the belief. It's the same with religion. There's a lot of people in LA who don't have any religious beliefs, but and their parents do. And weirdly, if their parents ever stopped having those religious beliefs, the children would feel a sense of loss.
Yeah.
So technically they think they don't have religious beliefs, but they do. They've just put them into the minds of their parents. This is one of the structures of belief that's interesting is we often don't know what we believe, but also we often put our beliefs into other people.
You can outsource them.
We can outsource our beliefs, and we do this all the time. In fact, that's why you can tell what somebody believes often by what they think everybody else thinks. Whenever people talk about what everybody thinks this.
I do that. I mean, I usually speak in terms of what people have said to me rather than what I think.
Yeah, or no, but even if you're saying what you think's going on in someone else's mind, that is a disavowed reflection of what's going on in your mind that you can't come to know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we all put our beliefs into things. That Christmas tree is a monument to something. And
it's a monument to Father Christmas.
Yeah. Monument to Father Christmas.
Oh man. Yeah, so you end up sad and you end up happy at the same time, and it's not that bad, and life is good, and this is life, and you go through phases.
Yeah, and also, right, we're talking about how we can be sad when we think we're happy, but also the other bit you have to put into this is that you can get a certain happiness from your sadness. And in other words, so sadness can give you a certain pleasure.
Yeah.
Now, the problem is sometimes you can't enjoy your pleasure. You can't enjoy the happiness you're getting from depression. So, for example, say a mother who sacrifices everything for her kids, always doing everything for her kids. There's a sense in which she might be getting something out of that. Mm-hmm. Although she's always maybe unhappy about it. Look how much I do and nobody cares about
me. Well,
that
kind of goes into the whole thing of like a lot of people just don't want happiness. And we're told that we're all striving for it and we think we're all striving for it. But like there's all sorts of things that are not happiness that are totally satisfying in some way. Like there's a satisfaction in giving of yourself so much that you don't have anything left. Yeah. You know,
you can you're getting something out of it.
Yeah, I have friends like that who they give and they give and they give, and it's like it can seem kind of selfish at points because you're like, do you not like I'm missing out on my friend, the full scope of my friend, because my friend will give and give and give and give and give, where it's to the point of like there's nothing left, like there's no like bones to the person anymore. It's like they've just sort of become this puddle of giving, and I'm like, great, well, good for you.
That's what an hysteric will try to lose themselves.
Lose themselves. And I said they don't have bones and they become a puddle. That makes total sense.
Yeah, it's a good way of describing kind of an hysterical attempt is to erase themselves, whereas an obsessive tries to erase the other person, can only really enjoy another person insofar as they are an object of desire and not a subject, blah, blah, blah. But you know, that's a good point. The really difficult thing then is working out what we're getting out of our own unhappiness. Now, sometimes not, because like lots of terrible things happen in life and that's different. But if you continually do something like sacrifice and nobody's making you do it, sometimes you have to go, why am I doing that? What enjoyment am I getting out of it? And am I enjoying my enjoyment? As in, am I actually able to, is it something that is pleasurable to me, or is it actually damaging my friendships and damaging everything? Those are good questions to ask.
Yeah, man, it's fun. Do you feel like you currently are existing with a low grade depressive state?
Yeah, it's hard
following
to say.
Because I mean, you live 20 feet from, this ray of sunshine.
Yes.
I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, maybe. No, but the big thing for me is having a bit of sadness is part of life. So the trick is not to get rid of your sadness. I mean, you want to get rid of some of it, but to be aware of it and to also see that something good can come out of it, etc. So I do think that we often try to avoid certain emotions. Mm-hmm. And often it's not even us. Like whenever people have a child that's crying, sometimes parents will do anything to stop the child from crying, as if crying sometimes is a bad thing. And then you learn to try to avoid that emotion as you grow up and go like, well, no, it's, you know, being sad is part of life and that's all right.
Interesting.
It's whether you can bear the full range of human emotions. That's what joy is for me. Joy is different from happiness. Happiness is the subjective feeling of pleasure.
The subjective what?
A feeling of pleasure. Like you have a nice cup of coffee, you happiness have a nice is holiday. That? Yeah, happiness is, I think, more a word we use to describe feeling good at a particular time. Whereas the term joy describes a certain feeling of getting pleasure out of not having. It's a certain weird pleasure. We've used this example before, but happiness is like opening the Christmas present. You go, oh, I got the new car. That's brilliant. And enjoyment is waiting to open the present. So you're enjoying this expectancy of not having. So joy is weirdly getting a pleasure out of not having the thing that you think will make you happy, which means that joy is a way of affirming life in the midst of its difficulties.
It feels like on a subjective level, to try to wax philosophical here, I remember when I was just had just separated from my ex. I was moving into this horrible, horrible place. The first time I'd lived alone, and it was this terrible, terrible, terrible place. And were, did you ever see that place?
Which
that
one
horrible was it? Was it sublet? It wasn't the place down the street. It was like I'd subleased it. I don't think you saw it.
I don't think I saw that one.
But yeah, that was a dark time. I remember being on the phone with my mom, and she was like, "What do you want? Like, are you trying to like seek happiness?" And I think we all kind of know the language now to avoid, especially if you've grown up in the church or if you've read, you know, six self-help books or one self-help book. But like using the term happy or like striving for happiness, it's kind of like, I think we're all aware that that's not the way you term it. Like it kind of takes a, if you're still stuck on like, I'm going to be happy all the time, then you're not quite at the level, I think, of most people now. But like most people understand. So I remember being like, well, I can't say that I'm trying to find happiness as I like exit my life. And I know that's not the truth, but I remember telling my mom, I was like, I'm looking for peace was the word I used. And, and I think that's a great word. And I don't know how much it relates to joy, but I do feel like the state that we're talking about, or at least the state that I'm in currently, is one in which like the difference between the state that I'm in now and the state that I was in for the majority of my 20s was like, now it just feels dissipated. It feels like, okay, wherever I'm at is an honest and authentic state. So like there's no like the tab that like I feel like I've left whatever situation I'm in currently is a result of having been active and honest and like pushing balls forward or pushing boulders up a hill or whatever. So like I don't feel an anxiety, I think, that I used to feel in my 20s, because it's not, I don't feel like a bundle of like comp, like, oh, this, it's like everyone, like, I'm just like, yeah, this is it. This is the situation. This is objective. Like this is not, objective is probably the wrong word, but this is the result of all of these actions. So be it. Whereas there's this other type of like real sad, depressive state, or real sad piece of it, like state of anxiety, where it's like, I want to do this. I want to get out. I want to feel this. I want to do this. And it's like, you're stuck in inaction. And I feel like I'm stuck in the aftermath of action. And I like that more. I feel like that's this level of sadness I can take because it's a result of something, not a result of not having done something, if that makes any sense.
Okay. I think so.
You didn't like it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I see what you... So you're... Say it again in a nutshell.
I guess, like, I would take this over most situations where, like, this version of unhappiness is one in which I feel completely...
All right, so you feel comfortable with a bit of sadness. You feel comfortable with that.
At least it's the sadness that comes from at least somewhat being in, like, the driver's seat a little bit.
Yeah,
whereas there's this whole other thing where, especially, like, I think this is the difference between, okay, here it is. This is my theory.
Well, that would be, by the way, enjoyment. I mean, if we use the term happiness.
Yeah, I think it's the same.
Happiness and joy is a happiness. We do get moments of happiness in our lives. Lots of them. There's millions of them. You know, every day there's probably moments of happiness. But happiness is a fleeting thing. But joy is an ability to affirm life in the midst of also the sad times.
And I feel like... the existential crisis that everyone goes through, I feel like there is a difference post-existential crisis and pre-existential crisis on how bad situations or being depressed is handled, at least in my experience. Like prior to existential crisis, it's very, very, very bad, intense and complex and gross and murky. And now post-existential crisis, it's very nice. That's my big theory on that.
That's true. And like in philosophy, that existential crisis is sometimes called the death of God, which doesn't mean like necessarily the loss of a belief in God. It simply means the moment when your entire world dissolves.
Yeah, I've been on a real kick with this death of God stuff lately. Right. I'm having a great time. I love it. I feel like it just seems like life is a fun series of just killing God after God after God. And the language is so heavy.
Yeah,
like that's such a violent.
It's a strong word.
And then when you realize that what you're talking about is not always God, but sometimes your career or the happiness that you're going to get from a relationship or something like that.
Yeah.
Like that's when it gets super interesting. Like that's the God. That's the thing that I think is going to make me super happy. This is but then you can't, we were talking about this a little bit. You can't like rationalize somebody into being like I believe that the one we were talking about, I think that there is a one or not a one. I think that there is someone out there who will make me believe that, that they're the one. And I will enter into that delusion. But like, I still hold that, you know, kind of like very sweet romantic thing. This is where going into the believer skeptic thing. And then objectively, I know that there's no person out there who's going to be like the all encompassing forever for me. And I know, I do know that, but I still know I'm going to have to go through the quote unquote death of God in a relationship or in romance or in love. And it's like, yeah. Oh, great. I got that coming down the pipeline. Yes. I don't know what that's going to look like, but I can't wait.
Yeah. I mean, that I think that's the main death of God for many people today is experiencing the loss of the fantasy that there is someone out there who will make you whole and complete.
Yeah.
I think that's a huge one. And it sounds depressing. So the death of God means that you realize that there is nobody there who is going to save you, who's going to make you whole. But the point is, in the death of God, is that it's actually that belief that makes things so difficult. It makes it so hard to meet somebody or somebody to raise up to that standard, or it causes all sorts of problems. And when you experience the death of that, that's the moment of depression. But post that, you return, it's called second naivety. You return to that belief, but differently. You go, I can be satisfied in my dissatisfaction.
Yeah.
That now I can find someone who is the one, not because they'll make me whole and complete, but because we will be dissatisfied together. We will hold each other's dissatisfaction. I will hold a space for the other's desire. And desire means not having. You desire what you don't have. And they will hold a space for my desire. And so you enter into a new form of satisfaction, but it's a satisfaction that encompasses dissatisfaction.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what that's for Nietzsche what the death of God is, in the sense that the death of God is not just the loss of a religious belief. It is the loss of any ideology, any system of belief that attempts to shield us from the flux and fluidity of existence.
But Nietzsche, I mean, wasn't he like any system, like even the ones that, like, he was against, like, anything. Like, he was just, like, anything that you think is anything isn't. Like, and so, therefore, the death of God is, like, society and, you know, the nuclear family and, like, all that. Like, it wasn't, like, isn't he, like, so, like, he's so extreme with it.
Well, yeah, he sees that, and this is so important for this reason, is that he sees the religious structure as operating within secularism as well. He sees that that we're almost like religious creatures by nature. Mm-hmm. So even when we think we have overcome religious beliefs, we actually have all sorts of religious superstitious beliefs that continue to manifest that we're not aware of.
Yeah, we have this thing, this potential opportunity at thevalleyfolk.com, and I keep just saying, like, I think this is going to happen. Like, I think this is a thing that's going to happen. Like, I think it's going to happen, and I'm excited about it. And whenever I say it, it sort of gets met with, like, just straight-up silence. And I think it feels religious. It feels like I'm saying the thing that if they say, it means it won't happen. Like, there's that whole thing
magical thinking.
Yeah, of, like, and it's magical thinking on my part, too, because I'm sitting there going, like, I make a joke about it, like, I know this is going to happen because I read The Secret, and I know that if I just say it's going to happen, it's going to happen. That's how it, like, but like at the same time, I would rather say it, hope for it, get excited about it. Why not? You know, who cares? It's more fun that way. But there is this sort of sense of like, we can't speak this. And I'm like, no, you can speak it.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Well, if it doesn't happen, well, then it doesn't happen. Yeah. And that's okay too.
And here's the irony that people don't. So if you go with Nietzsche and philosophy, you get to this idea that then these structures of religion are in secularism as well. And then if you push it far enough, you find that this line of thought, and particularly it's seen in people like Ernst Bloch, in Lacan and Zizek, the idea that actually to escape religion, the only way to do it is by going through religion. So there's a great seminar online that people can listen to called Why Only a Christian Can Be an Atheist by Slavoj Zizek. Or why only an atheist can believe, something like that. And it's a seminar that kind of gets into this idea. But the weird thing is that it's actually through religion that you escape religion.
Yeah, I remember I wrote this thing one time that was, it's basically was like, the gravitas. I don't think people really talk about this. I think this is a reason people like gravitate toward you a lot and people in your world. But like the traumatic event of accepting the like wrong, not only the wrongness, but just like the baggage that comes along with like a lot of religious stuff, especially in like the evangelical communities. I feel like that if you really think about it, what happens with this whole generation of people who don't really see their voices, I think, heard in mainstream media in any way, like these, the sort of emergent Christianity or whatever you want to call it. I know that's like not a good term, but people who are escaping unhealthy religious structures, there's not really a outlet for them. There's not really a voice in like popular media because it's such an insular experience. But I think it's such a powerful experience that doesn't really get talked about. Like when, if you really go through, and you could read, I could read your books, or I could read, you know, Rob Bell, I could read all these things. But when you really go, when you really accept that this thing that you believed in just isn't, not like I don't believe it anymore, mm-hmm. which is its own thing. Like that's like the objective, like I don't believe this. I've decided what I believe and what I don't believe in. Like, that's great. But when you really stop believing, when you really are like, eh, it's done, that's such a massively disappointing thing. And it's a painful thing to find out that there's no eternal life after this and that this is it or whatever. If you really process that. And so it makes sense that to say that it would take a Christian to be an atheist, like you need to know how badly you can be disappointed, I think, yeah. in order to really grasp this sort of like, well, I don't believe that anymore. Yeah. It's like,
well,
why don't...
A way of thinking about this, if I can put kind of some frame around it, is we all have mythologies and ways of thinking. And so we all have myths. And what happens when one myth gives up for us, and that means that whatever religious worldview, for example, you have, it stops working for you. What you will tend to do is move from one unbroken myth to another unbroken myth. So you'll move from one religion to another or to some sort of secular thing. But for someone like Paul Tillich, the idea is not necessarily to move from one myth to another myth, but rather to realize that the myth is broken and to be able to live within a broken myth. Basically, that's what conversion is for Tillich, is not the movement from one mythology to another mythology, but from an unbroken mythology to a broken one. And that, weirdly, you can argue is the kind of the core of a way of reading Christianity, is that whenever you stop believing in it, that's actually the highest affirmation of it, is that you're able to exist within a broken mythology. So, I mean, all that to say, it's more difficult for us to embrace a certain radical unknowing than it is to move from one system of belief to another. We all find that easy. One system of belief's not working, let's move to another. But embracing a fractured belief system is more traumatic to us. But that I think is actually what we need to learn how to do.
Go from
from an unbroken myth to a broken myth.
Yeah.
And in someone like Paul Tillich, he's saying that this actually is what the heart of religion is when you stop believing in religion, you are experiencing the highest form of religion, which is, you know, there's various religious terms for this, but crucifixion, for example, is the experience of the loss of all sense of grounding in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea of God dying, the idea of the highest being crucified is like basically the entire way of thinking about the world, the universe, is thrown into disarray.
You know, I remember two things. There's two points here. One is I remember when I was exiting Christianity, I remember my mom saying like, well, just don't do like the psychoanalysis thing. She's like, just don't stay away from that because that's like very left is right, up is down kind of thing. And of course, the moment I'm told that, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to dive into this and see what this is all about. And so that's one thing. But the other thing was like, I remember I went to New York with my brother and mom at one point. We were like talking very heavily, very deeply. And I was basically like, it was kind of a political, religious, personal conversation that was like encompassing all these things. It was really cool. But one of the political things that we'd been talking about kind of at the beginning of the trip was like, my generation is seeing a complete, because my mom was like, we just need more young people in politics. And then I was like, well, the young people see that this is all bullshit. Like my generation doesn't believe in the system anymore. Like, so, or at least it seems that way. We're seeing behind the curtain, Trump has sort of revealed how silly a lot of this stuff is and how propped up it's become. And we sort of have imagined the office of the presidency to be this like mystical thing of power and you know, wisdom and elegance. And now we're seeing that it's just like, oh, he's just like it's not like if he's that and then the office of the presidency is that. It's like, so there's a skepticism that comes with all this stuff. And I basically was like, then that segued into more of a personal conversation where I was like, you know, Mom, I was like, here's the deal. Religion, super disappointing. I was like, that's, you get at it. It's not good. I was like, so we experience, this is one thing where there's the death of God, quote unquote, the crucifixion, of the crucifixion, so to speak. And then there is the political thing of like, this is all bullshit. Like, nobody's really believing any of this anymore. And so I remember telling my mom in New York, I was like, every system seems to be revealing itself to be nothing, like dust. And I was like, the only thing that remains right now, I was like, is yours and Dad's marriage. Like, I was like, that's the thing. I was like, my parents have this perfect love, this perfect marriage. And for some reason, in my early 30s, I've been able to kind of carry that fantasy. Mm-hmm. And in New York, I was like, just so you know, I was like, I'm smart enough to know that this is an illusion and that it's okay. I was like, whatever happens, it's okay. I was like, you guys don't need to pretend all the time anymore that things are perfect. And it was a very like beautiful conversation. I won't go into like, you know, it's probably what happened. The conversation following that is very private, but it was a very beautiful thing. But it was like the realization that, oh, all of this, like even my mommy and daddy, who have never fought in front of me. They always like hug. They're still married. They love each other, all that stuff. Even they are going, we can't keep keeping this. You can't keep thinking that everything's perfect.
Well, that's a great example. For many people, their parents' marriage is the one thing. Again, like we're talking about disavowed belief, is that there's people out there and there's, you know, people sleeping around, having multiple relationships, kind of like cynical. And yet, without them knowing it, they have a fantasy of their parents having this, you know, mm-hmm. perfect relationship. And then if they see their parents divorce, their world can crumble. And it's weird because at first you're going like, well, if you ask that person, do you believe in, you know, love forever that lasts, whatever, they might go, oh no, I'm not into that. That's not what I do. But their parents' marriage acts as a type of disavowed fantasy that is in operation. And when the parents, when you find out that your parents aren't like, because, you know, everyone has their problems, but say you find your parents, they get divorced, it can lead to the experience of the death of God in you. So that's a very good example of how in a secular culture, the death of God is often experienced.
And it becomes a bit of a game too, because it's like, well, okay, got it. Like that's coming. It's like this is the happily part of the happily depressed thing, where it's like, all right, so my parents, that is, I know even how they are is how they are. And I don't really truly know, only they know. And, if they know,
and I say they likely don't.
Yeah, exactly. Themselves, they're figuring it out just like everybody else is figuring it out. So there's that, and then there's like, well, I know that I still think that there's like this wondrous love, you know, and I'm sure there is, and there's wonderful times, wonderful things coming down the pipeline, all that, blah blah blah. But it's like the death of God framework is so fun; it keeps it interesting to be like, well, now I know this, and I feel like my parents' marriage is the last thing, but that means my brain is just going to come up with something else that's like the perfect thing. That, oh, my relationship will be perfect. My relationship will be, or after this, my career, it's like, there's
this,
no,
this,
yeah.
And the breakdown of this entire structure can be called traversing the fantasy in psychoanalysis or conversion in religion, which basically means, it's like when you're a kid, you think your primary caregiver is everything. In a sense, they are God, but they know your needs better than you know yourself. Like, you cry and they respond, and they respond in a way that makes you feel better if you're in a healthy environment. But then you discover that you can't be everything to your parents. So you realize your mother, you can't, you know, your mother has other interests. She desires her husband, she desires her work. And this is called alienation, where you experience a separation from your
mother. It's not all about me,
But But what remains is the idea that your mother is like, you can realize that you can't satisfy your mother completely, but you can still have the fantasy that how can you say this? Sorry, it's like you experience a separation, but you still have this notion of the mother being everything, of a type of God. And then the second separation is where you realize that your mother also is just human and isn't perfect and has multiple desires and unhappiness. And the reason why I'm talking about this is often what we're doing in life is we're trying to find that other who has the answer, who knows us better than we know ourselves, religious gurus, people on TV, superstars, rock stars, someone who knows me better than I know myself. We are very susceptible to trying to find the one who, even if we're cynical, we are very susceptible to these fantasies. And actually the challenge is to overcome that fantasy, not so that you despair, but actually so that you can be a freer person, yeah, and actually enjoy your life. And so the marriage thing for you, which is that's a brilliant one, because I think it's so true for so many of us. The fantasy,
I realized it was one of those things too, that I realized in conversation.
Yeah.
Like, or like a moment before I was like, oh, I do view you guys as like the last, I think the term I use was the last bastion of certainty.
Yeah. Like we all, like so many
and I
of
love
us,
that because so, I sounded yeah. cool when I felt yeah. cool when I said it. Yeah.
But so many of us require some other who, as I say, whether it's our parents' marriage or whether it's our children's belief in Santa Claus or whether it's our friends' belief in religion, we weirdly need some other who holds these fantasies that we think we've given up.
Dude, this is why I want kids. I want kids yeah. so I can believe in Santa Claus again.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, that's
like, I just want the opportunity. Yeah. It was yeah. fun the first go around. It can't not be fun the second go around because yeah. this time I know the deal.
Yeah, yeah. It's yeah, I mean, that's one of the wonderful things I think about having kids around. That's
a hell of a lot of work just to get yeah. to that one delusion.
Just to get to enjoy Christmas again.
Yeah.
But yeah, the traversing the fantasy is where you are freed from this weird thing of requiring some fantasy of perfection and wholeness, and yeah. of actually being able to embrace the fracturedness of reality. And that's the move from an unbroken myth to a broken myth, which I argue is actually one of the kind of subversive messages of religion.
Yeah. Yep. I love that. How interesting too is it that like one of the things, like I touched on it for a second, but like my mother being like, stay away from psychoanalysis because it means that left is right and up is down. And it's like, well, she wasn't wrong.
No, not at all.
Like it was a mother talking to a son going, don't dive into that. Don't yeah. dive off of that cliff. And like, what a sweet thing for a mom to do for a son. I mean, on one hand, you want to, you know, you're to be like, oh, go, you know, follow your path. But it's so yeah. nice. It's like, there's a beauty in like the parent being like, yeah. don't go into that pit. I think that's a very nice thing. Yeah. And of course, me being like, no, I can do it.
I know. Yeah. But I mean, what she's describing is dialectics, which is sadly the truth of basically every academic discipline, is when you go deep enough in, up is down and left is right, that academic disciplines generally overturn our common sense experience of the world. And you get that in physics, and you get that in philosophy, you get that in psychoanalysis. Yeah. But the trick in psychoanalysis, which is different from, say, counseling, is that it's actually going into that disruptive, disorienting space mm-hmm. that you find. You actually find freedom from the tyranny of the fantasy of wholeness, and you find a liberation in the messiness of life itself.
Pete, we have a few minutes left on this podcast. Yeah. I mean, not that we are under any sort of time frame, but
yeah,
we
could technically have ours left if we wanted.
I want to ask you something.
Yeah.
Well, no, because I have to drive to
San Francisco. You know,
I'm very much looking forward to it. But prior to this podcast, I'm curious what people are thinking who are listening to this. A unique thing about this particular episode is, not a unique thing, but one of the more unique things, is that you did not prepare anything, and you yeah. were worried you wouldn't have anything to say. And I was like, it's all in there, man. I was like, you've said so many good things this episode. How do you, like, you do you feel a lack of...
You know, I worry because here's the thing. It's really nice you're bringing this up, right? Because, mm-hmm. and this is the way I want the
it
podcast
is very
to
nice.
Be. Right? So this is exactly what, you know, I want it to be. But there is this fear in me because I talked about, for example, broken and unbroken myths. Mm-hmm. That requires a couple of hours to dissect.
Sure.
And I worry that just throwing that out is less than meaningful. It's actually, you know, whenever I, so some of the stuff that I say.
You do like 8 seminars a day or something on Patreon. Yeah. People can find
people your... can find. Well, that's as long as they know that if you're if any of these ideas sound interesting to you, there's lots of seminars out there by me and others that unpick it. So that's my only worry. Yes,
if you want to remove the fun part and the interesting part and just listen to the the academic shit, that is available.
Yes, that is
at patreon.com/PeterRollins.
And thank you for bringing this up, because that makes me, as long as I say this, as long as I have this disclaimer, like on cigarettes, like these cigarettes might cause cancer, as long as I have a disclaimer saying like, yeah, we're throwing the ideas around, but we're not getting systematic with them. We're basically doing a type of dynamic philosophy, then I'm happy. It's like, that's great. Just know that there's deeper ways to go after this.
Yeah, you don't want to be sold short in your sort of understand, because it is difficult. I feel like I was talking about this in a podcast I was doing the other week, but it's like
promoting your other
podcast. Yeah. No, it was not my podcast, which is why it's funny I didn't say it. I don't know the name of it. Stuff they don't tell you. I think Steve Green and Nikki Lima, but I was like, we live in disclaimer land now, where it's like you feel as I speak, I have a voice in my head going like, don't forget to say that, because you can hear now, thanks to the internet, the criticisms in real time in your head. And it's like, then when you read the tweet, you're like, I knew I was going to get that.
Yes. I could see that coming. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I should have said this. And if I'd have said this, then I would have gotten him and I wouldn't have to read this. But it's like,
yeah,
who cares? You know?
That's true. Well, that's it. And what I love about the podcast format is it hopefully is a place where people, and I think people understand that you can't have 100 disclaimers, that it's actually just a bit of a conversation back and forth.
And do you feel, not gonna do it, I almost just did the thing, but do you feel now in this podcast that you don't need to be as prepared following this experience?
I'd like to experiment with that.
So that means that as a whole, you yourself can, your perspective, your outlook on things can change and grow.
Well, hopefully always.
Almost at the direction of some sort of hand that guides us through. What if the podcast becomes me trying to convert you into
I think that's what that's what a couple of my friends have said. It's like, this podcast is basically Elliot trying to convert me into... into kind of like a mystical thing, and me trying to convert you out of it.
Yeah,
like you are the believer.
You can't tell in the way we talk, but we're arguing constantly.
Yes, there is a constant underlying argument in all of these fundamentalist podcasts.
That's so funny.
Which weirdly isn't in our everyday life, because we must save it for this. Argument for this podcast.
But at the same time, I don't feel like we disagree on anything. I just feel like I don't care. Maybe I don't care. I don't care enough to not believe. And the things that I believe in.
And here's the thing, by the way, if someone's
I'm nihilistically Christian, I think.
Well, I would say that's my position. And maybe that's your position but we'd have to interpret it differently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll believe because, like, why not?
Yeah.
Well, that's more like...
But for me, more Christianity is the loss of belief. So anyway. But if you're interested in these ideas, I actually have another podcast that virtually nobody knows about because they never talk about it. It's just a talks archive of like various talks I've given.
There you go.
So,
and people find that just on iTunes. People can find it,
and you know, then that will be me giving slightly more in-depth stuff without any enjoyment, any fun or...
Without any fun tales of heartbreak.
And with no adverts for Wink.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You should throw one in there.
Any takeaways?
I don't know. No. I'm sick and I don't want to go to San Francisco is my big takeaway. I do want to go to San Francisco. I don't want to have to drive to San Francisco. Yeah. I want to be in San Francisco.
Yeah. I love that's your takeaway. My takeaway is I don't want to go to San Francisco.
My takeaway is I've forgotten what we talked about.
Well, you know what? But that's a great takeaway. That's showing you you're being honest with yourself. I'm connecting with myself and being honest, and there you go. That's a good step.
You know what my takeaway is, Pete? A nice, lovely person, and I'm gonna find them, and we're gonna live happily ever after in the bliss of dissatisfaction. You happy?
Come on, I'm your one.
I'm your one. That. Yeah, yeah. That's
that's a
peep show. Yeah,
peep
yeah.
show quote.
That's the last line of the. I'm his one. Is that like the last episode?
It's not actually the last episode. Oh no, but it's in the last season.
I'm his one. It's so good. God dang, that show is so funny.
It's so good.
It has to be point for point, probably.
By the way, you didn't turn off the coffee machine, and the coffee machine turns off itself.
I know.
Do you not know this by now? You have to turn the coffee machine off before we start.
Right, 4 seconds before the hour mark.
Oh, wow. I know.
I'm sorry, Pete.
I try to talk over it.
If it's any consolation, I'm going to turn it right back on when we're done.
Yeah. Well, here, one of my takeaways in this, I liked particularly, I think, the bit where we talked about how we can create monuments to our sadness when we don't know it ourselves.
Name one.
I'm looking at it right now.
You're going to bring up the elephant tree in the room.
The elephant tree in the room, this tree. I'm not going to be able to look at it in the same light now that I think it's a monument to your despair.
Nah,
your
existential it was. Despair. It was born out of despair, but it is in being born out of despair, it is a symbol of beauty and something that definitely looks like it could be in a Macy's.
Yeah. Well, in light of that, then, the takeaway is, you know, look at the stuff that you have and the way you act and what you do and see if it can tell you something about yourself that you are not able to tell yourself, just like the child's teddy bear was able to tell the child something that it didn't know but was in itself. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
I love it. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for listening.